This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 16th of September, these are our main stories. We get the latest on the man suspected of trying to assassinate Donald Trump. Germany reintroduces controls on all external borders. An American pastor held in a Chinese jail for 18 years is finally home. And the UN speaks out on Gaza. Also in this podcast,
the mail officer told me to take off my coat and lay down on the bed. He was holding a black leather whip in one hand.
Rare testimony from women in Iran who say they've been persecuted because of social media activity. New concerns have been raised in the United States about the safety of presidential candidates after an apparent second attempt in 2 months on the life of Donald Trump. The former president was unharmed when shots were fired at a Florida golf course where he was playing on Sunday. A suspect named by US media as Ryan Routh was later arrested. He's expected to appear in court later. The Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, said people deserved the truth about how a would-be assassin was able to get within 500 yards, 400 metres, of Mr. Trump. Security has been tightened around the former president after the shooting in Pennsylvania in July, in which he suffered a wound to his ear. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is in Florida at the West Palm Beach course.
Where I'm standing now, which is on the perimeter, on the edge of the Trump International Golf Club, that's his private golf club here in West Palm Beach. The former president was moving from the fifth to the sixth hole, and there was an advanced detail of Secret Service agents who were sweeping the area that he was about to head into when they spotted what they described as the barrel of a rifle pointing through a chain link fence in the bushes here. And that's when they engaged this suspect. They fired at the man hiding in the bushes. He then fled, got into a black Nissan and drove off. So since then, they have detained a suspect that they identify as the same person who fled this scene. He's now being held in the county jail, potentially ahead of a court appearance this morning. What is unclear at the moment is still whether or not this man fired at the Secret Service agents or at Donald Trump himself. We don't have that confirmed yet. They were asked that question directly in the news conference, and all they've said about that is they know that their Secret Service agents shot at the suspect. Whether or not he shot towards them or towards the former president is still a focus of their investigation.
And this obviously raises more questions about the former president's security.
Well, it does, because remember, it's just over 2 months since Donald Trump was the subject of a first attempted assassination at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. That precipitated the resignation of the director of the Secret Service over failures to protect him effectively in that incident. And here we are yet again with a second apparent attempt here. Now, I think there's a couple of things to say about the way this is being looked at here. I mean, it is certainly clear that the fact they spotted this gun in the bushes potentially saved Donald Trump's life. So there will be a lot of tribute, and there has been tributes over that fact. But the wider issue is about securing the perimeter of the golf course. It's long been a concern of the Secret Service and other law enforcement officials about his vulnerability when he plays golf. I mean, sometimes, you know, there are members of the public on these golf courses in very close vicinity when he is playing. And there seems to have been a bit of a patchwork approach to how they're protected.
Tom Bateman. Ryan Routh's social media profile suggests that he's been involved in efforts to get foreign fighters into Ukraine. This was him speaking in June 2022.
These flags represent the civilians that are here fighting. It doesn't represent the government, but we are keeping account of all the civilians that are here fighting that have come from their own countries. They've sold everything they've owned. They've sold their vehicles, their cars, their motorcycles, everything, to come here and support Ukrainians. So it is truly heroic what these kids and adults have done as far as getting here on their own dime and spending their own money to come here and fight with the Ukrainians.
Mr. Routh was speaking there to a French freelance journalist, Guillaume Pitak, who's based in Kyiv. He told my colleague, Cassia Madeira, how he'd come across Mr. Routh in the Ukrainian capital 2 years ago.
I was talking with some passerbys, and I think he overheard me mentioning that I was a journalist. So he asked me straight up if I could record his message or his appeal to the world, if you will. So I didn't see much interest in it as a story, in the sense that it was just a lone volunteer sitting in the middle of the capital already 6 months, well, 4 months into the full-scale invasion. But I thought I would be doing him a favor because the man was already kind of, as you can say, seen the video teary-eyed, seemed very emotional, seemed, as far as I could tell, well-meaning, well-intentioned, a bit kooky, some might say, but well-meaning. So we kind of sat down and introduced himself. So he said he was from Hawaii, that he had sold most of his possessions to come to Ukraine, that he was refused entry into the International Legion of Ukraine to fight because he was considered too old. He told me that he was, I think, in his late 50s at the time, and introduced himself as a recruiter for the International Legions and whatever. And then he went into this kind of rant about how the world is not doing enough, about how countries are not doing enough to help Ukraine. And generally seemed very, very emotional. He mentioned his own personal situation a number of times, meaning, as I said, that he had sold most of his possessions, that he had traveled halfway across the world to come to Ukraine, and that basically we were not doing enough to help the country that was being invaded and that is still being invaded by Russia.
Guillaume, this is extraordinary. We have to obviously be careful because this man has now been arrested. He's a suspect in this apparent assassination attempt of the former president, Donald Trump. But when you realised that this was the man who you spoke to just a couple of years ago, what was your reaction?
I basically woke up this morning to the phone pinging constantly with notifications, mostly from X, formerly known as Twitter, because some people found that video that I had posted on social media back in the days. As far as I can recall, it was a call to action, not so much for the government, but to the people, that people should take matters into their own hands, basically, you know, come over to Ukraine and fight, meaning that people should get off their couch, take up a rifle and go fight individually.
Journalist Guillaume Pitak. To Germany now, where authorities have reintroduced border checks at all 9 of the country's land borders in a move that has drawn criticism from several European partners. Critics describe the move as a panicked response to the electoral rise of the far-right party, the AfD. The spokesman for the Federal Police, Dieter Hutt, said he did not expect there would be many delays for motorists.
Our controls are very flexible and dependent on the situation, which means we're not setting up the classic border post, and we do not check every vehicle or every person. Rather, the checks are targeted at vehicles where we suspect illegal migration. By doing so, we want to keep the inconvenience for commuters and the transfer of goods to a minimum.
I asked our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, what exactly the German government had done and why.
They already had border controls in place on their eastern and southern borders. So alongside countries like Poland, the Czech Republic, Austria as well, particularly routes that have been well known for being used as migrant crossing points. What they've now done is extend these border controls, which are essentially spot checks. We're not talking about a hard border here, to all of their borders, including in the north with Denmark, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg. So as you say, all of their land borders now. Initial reports that we've seen so far this morning suggest traffic is flowing fairly freely. And look, I've seen those border controls in operation where they were already in place in the south and the east. I mean, they're very varied to absolutely no kind of control on quiet country roads whatsoever, visible at least, to busier highways I saw from Poland, where lorries and trucks, basically vehicles where potentially people might be hidden or there'd be the capacity to hide people within them, were being pulled over and checked. So I think it will be quite varied. It's really not something where you're going to see every vehicle flagged over, every person's paperwork checked. But there is some political signalling here going on as well, even though the practicalities by some are being questioned.
But the whole point of the Schengen border-free area in Europe is that there aren't any borders.
Yeah, and some people are accusing Germany of undermining this. That being said, they're not the first country to do something like this. These controls, they have to be temporary. That's the kind of rule here, that if you want to apply in essentially an extraordinary situation, some kind of border control, at the moment these are only supposed to last for 6 months, although they can then get rolled over. They have been used in other countries, for example, if there's a major sporting event or a security concern of some description. So Germany isn't sort of necessarily breaking new ground, except for the fact they are doing it on all their borders. And of course, as well, Germany, the largest EU economy, often seen as the engine for economic growth in Europe, although their economy is fairly flatlining at the moment. And I think some are accusing them of doing this to pander to what we're seeing, well, in terms of, you mentioned it before, the success of the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, which immigration is their kind of signature issue, and they've done very well in two recent regional elections and could do well in another regional election this coming Sunday.
Jessica Parker in Berlin. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has declared a state of natural disaster as floodwaters inundate parts of the country, forcing thousands from their homes. At least four people have died on the Polish-Czech border. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford is there, and I asked her what the situation was like now.
There's, I guess, a little bit of good news this morning here in Nysa, because the rains have stopped and it does seem like in the main river that's been raging right through the centre of this town, the water levels have dropped a little bit. The reservoir too, the level has gone down slightly, because the fear overnight was that there's a dam that's burst upriver from here and everyone locally had been told to expect a wave of water heading towards this town. That didn't happen overnight, so people are breathing huge sighs of relief, because there's a lot of people here who've been extremely worried about their homes, about their businesses. Yesterday we saw really dramatic scenes late at night as the military rolled in to one area of town where a road looked exactly like a huge and very fast-moving river, and in the middle of all of that water there was a fire truck that had got trapped and a military truck too. So pretty dramatic scenes throughout the day yesterday. As I say, things slightly calmer today, but still people very nervous about what might yet be to come here.
Donald Tusk has declared a state of natural disaster. What does that mean in practice?
In practice, that means that there's recourse to funding and to assistance from the EU. It means that Poland can call on the EU for help with logistics, for help with transport, potentially with more helicopters if they need it, and more vehicles to help evacuate people and to help with the rescue and the recovery, essentially. It also gives the government a little bit more power if they need to control population movements, if they need to order people to evacuate, or if they need to implement some kind of curfew or anything like that.
And Sarah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's not just that area. This is over a large part of Central and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Romania very, very badly affected. Several people killed there. We now know four people have lost their lives in Poland. In the Czech Republic, at the last count, I think at least four people have been swept away by the waters. And remember that a lot of people in this region think back to 1997, the moment that was called the Millennium Flood, the great floods of 1997. Now, in those floods, more than 100 people were killed. And lots of people are pointing out now that people locally and the authorities locally are much better prepared. They have more floodgates in place. They know better how to deal with this kind of emergency.
Sarah Rainsford. Now to what could be one of the biggest financial scandals ever to engulf football. The hearing into Manchester City's 115 charges for alleged breaches of the English Premier League's financial rules has started. Justin Webb spoke to the BBC's sports editor Dan Rowan.
These 115 charges relate to the 14 seasons after City's Abu Dhabi takeover back in 2008, which of course transformed it into one of the richest clubs in the world. This was a period, these 14 seasons, in which they achieved unprecedented domination of the English game, winning several titles. And in effect, they are accused of subverting financial rules that limit club spending on players, in effect cheating the regulations. They include 54 counts of failing to provide accurate financial information over 9 seasons, 14 of not providing full details for manager and player payments, several counts of failing to comply with both UEFA and Premier League rules, and then also 35 counts of failure to cooperate with an investigation that was conducted over 4 years. The most serious charges relate to an allegation that City effectively inflated commercial revenue, Justin, by disguising direct investment from the club's Abu Dhabi owners as sponsorship income. Right. But it's important to stress the club denies all charges and say they have a body of irrefutable evidence that will, they say, clear them.
Who actually makes the decision?
Well, this is a Premier League arbitration disciplinary process. So it's a three-person panel. It's expected to last around 10 weeks. It starts today at a location that hasn't been disclosed in central London.
Really? What is it? It's at a secret location.
This is not held in public. This is an internal disciplinary process. Expected to last more than 2 months, and then there'll be a considerable amount of time potentially of deliberation. So it may not be until next year. But this has been rumbling on now since 2018, would you believe, when allegations first came to light. The Premier League set up an investigation around that time, and they were charged, in fact, City back in February of 2023. So this has been rumbling on. This has become a huge saga for the league.
And is it right that ultimately it could require them to be relegated, which would be an extraordinary kind of world story, wouldn't it?
Unprecedented and seismic for a club that enjoys such domination. If they were found guilty of the most serious charges, I think, you know, City would risk being forever associated with one of the biggest financial scandals that sport's seen. And they could, yes, in theory, face a points deduction serious enough to condemn them to relegation or even expulsion from the Premier League. Now, such a fate would cast a long shadow, wouldn't it, over City's achievements. He could even spark claims for compensation. For a case that's been billed as sport's trial of the century, today certainly marks a defining stage in a legal dispute, the like of which English football has never seen. And as well as the club, there's a huge amount at stake for the Premier League as well at a time of various regulatory challenges.
Dan Rowan talking to Justin Webb. Still to come in this podcast.
I've tried so many times to put into words what working on Baby Radio meant to me, and I fail every time. So I'm going to sing. No.
The mega hits and misses for this year's Emmy Awards, celebrating the best in television. The UN's most senior official overseeing aid and reconstruction in Gaza has said the international community is failing innocent civilians. Speaking to the BBC from New York, Sigrid Karg, the senior UN coordinator for humanitarian action and reconstruction in Gaza, described the territory as the most unsafe place in the world to work. Ms. Karg was speaking in a rare interview with our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
My main message is of a very sombre and perhaps dark nature, that humanitarian conditions in Gaza, as well documented and reported, are akin to a significant catastrophe, that we've built all systems to be in place, but there's no substitute for political will and the political choice to improve matters. The ceasefire and release of the hostages is desperately needed. Not much else can be improved until we reach that point.
Is the UN failing the people of Gaza?
It's too easy to say we're failing. What we are doing collectively, I would say, as an international community, is we are failing the innocent civilians in Gaza. And that comes out of the political environment. The UN is working around the clock. The so-called enabling environment in Gaza is actually counter to anything else we've witnessed in other places. It's highly unsafe.
So let's look at the political environment. For example, the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, said he has repeatedly and forcefully raised his concerns with Israeli officials. He said, regrettably, they have not been addressed satisfactorily. Have your concerns been addressed satisfactorily?
My mission has constructive discussions. We put asks on the table. Some of them are met. We also obtain commitments. But between the commitment and the time that it takes to actually seek and see visible and tangible implementation, too much time passes. There is not a day, not a second to lose.
But it's month after month, as you know, it's just getting worse. So your mandate is failing?
The only metric that matters is change in the well-being, in the conditions of people on the ground.
But that is getting worse, the well-being of the people of Gaza?
We can't say that aid hasn't gotten in, but it's insufficient. It is not broad enough in the scope of goods people need, but in nowhere does it meet the totality of needs. And these needs are an expression of rights.
Israeli officials tell us that one of the main reasons for the aid shortage is that Hamas is stealing the aid, which means the United Nations is not controlling it. Is that the issue?
We hear that a lot. I find that very difficult to confirm. I know that our colleagues, the different UN organizations, are working, they're distributing, they're monitoring, they're securing the assistance and through their operations and partners and actually making sure it reaches people. I can't say that everything goes right all the time. This is a war zone.
You are one of the few senior UN officials who meets senior Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Netanyahu. How does he explain to you why more trucks are not going in? Why Gaza is on the brink of famine, if not already in famine?
I don't have the habit to comment publicly on what I discuss in closed-door meetings. But what is important is that we are very clear on our asks and our observations. These are serious discussions, and we continue to press on the follow-up.
The UN's Sigrid Karg talking to Lise Doucet. After serving nearly 20 years of a life sentence in a Chinese prison, a US pastor is back home with his family in Texas following his release. David Lin was jailed in 2006, a decision which was criticized by the American government. The development comes a few weeks after the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was in Beijing trying to secure Mr. Lin's freedom. He's been calling on Beijing to free two other Americans serving jail time in China. I spoke to our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, earlier.
Well, David Lin was born in China, but is a naturalized US citizen. He wasn't actually a Christian when he first went to the United States, but became one and then decided that his role in life was to be a missionary back home in the place of his birth, China. So from the 1990s, he increasingly went there on this kind of work. In 2006, he was detained and eventually he was charged with contract fraud. Essentially what he was doing, he was trying to help an underground, unofficial church in Beijing to build a meeting hall. That's why he was charged. He was sentenced to life in prison. Essentially, that's where he's been since. For a brief period, or for actually the first decade of his time in prison, he asked his family not to campaign for his release. He took his time in prison as thought he could take part in missionary work. But about 6 years ago, he appears to have changed his mind, asked his family to campaign for his release. They did that, and now he's been released and flown home to his family in Texas.
And why did China choose to free him now?
It's a difficult question to answer because China hasn't officially said. They've reduced his sentence a couple of times in the subsequent years. He was due to be released at the end of this decade, but surely something to do with the pressure put on China by the United States to release a prisoner they believed had been incarcerated because of spurious charges. Also, the background to this is improving relations between Beijing and Washington. Beijing particularly wants to make sure it has better relations with America, and so releasing an American it has in prison is a gesture of goodwill towards that.
Mickey Bristow. The BBC has spoken to people in Iran who say they've been unduly followed, arrested and punished by the state for speaking out against the Islamic Republic on social media. Their testimonies come 2 years after the Women Life Freedom protests ignited by the death of Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody after she was arrested and, according to eyewitnesses, beaten for wearing the mandatory hijab loosely around her head. BBC trending reporter Reha Kansara has more. A warning, this report includes distressing accounts of violence.
I didn't really care enough to hide who I am or where the photo was taken. I wanted to say, we exist.
Last year, Alif was arrested after her social media post was picked up by the Iranian authorities. The post, a photo of her with her long black hair flowing freely, was an act of defiance in a country where the hijab is required by law.
Why did I do that? Because I needed an outlet for all my pent-up emotions to share them with people who thought like me.
Alif, whose name we've changed for security reasons and whose words are spoken by an actor, was soon arrested.
They blindfolded and handcuffed me, put my head on the seat, and when we arrived at the location, they put me in a solitary cell overnight. The interrogation began the next day. They released my hands. And the male officer told me to take off my coat and lay down on the bed. He was holding a black leather whip in one hand. That's when he started hitting me all over my body. It was very painful. But I didn't want to show weakness.
She's one of five Iranians we've spoken to whose court documents reveal that the Iranian authorities built cases using their online posts to charge them for propaganda against the state. Three receive suspended sentences like Alif. No lashes, but fines and the threat of further, tougher retribution looming over them. One woman faced prison time and fled the country. Emma Rashidi, Director of Internet Security and Digital Rights at the MIAN Group, calls Iran a surveillance state and says its techniques mimic China's.
They can geolocate where is your mobile phone. They can see what mobile phone is connected to what kind of IP addresses. And then they figure out what's the identity of the people who are using that particular mobile phone.
An ecosystem of surveillance has helped the authorities crush dissent quickly and efficiently. Since 2009, the government has blocked Western social media apps like Instagram, Twitter, and Telegram because they cannot control them. But Iranians have bypassed the bans, using VPNs to disguise their locations and use these platforms. We contacted the Iranian government and put forward to them all the allegations contributors and experts made to the BBC. They did not get back to us. 2 years on, the death of Mahsa Amini reverberates across the country. Though mass demonstrations have come to a halt, people are protesting in more subtle ways. And this movement, that's led by women and driven by a right to life and freedom, shows no signs of stopping.
It's like seeds of a flower. Even if a flower withers or dries out, its seeds go on and flower elsewhere. We now speak often in our family and friendship circles about the Women Life Freedom Movement and our experience of it.
BBC trending reporter Reha Kansara. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has declared a state of natural disaster as floodwaters inundate parts of the country, forcing thousands from their homes. Several countries have been affected. At least four people have died on the Polish-Czech border. Our Eastern European correspondent Sarah Rainsford is there. I asked her what the situation was like now.
There's, I guess, a little bit of good news this morning here in Nysa because the rains have stopped and it does seem like in the main river that's been raging right through the centre of this town, the water levels have dropped a little bit. The reservoir too, the level has gone down slightly because the fear overnight was that there's a dam that's burst upriver from here and everyone locally had been told to expect a wave of water heading towards this town. That didn't happen overnight, so people are breathing huge sighs of relief because there's a lot of people here who've been extremely worried about their homes, about their businesses. All around the reservoir, people have been evacuated and moved to higher ground. And this morning, we were down by the riverbank and people were coming down to check out the situation, slightly relieved, as I say, but still nervous because there are reports of still immense water pressure on dams and on rivers all over this region. And yesterday, we saw really dramatic scenes late at night as the military rolled in to one area of town where a main road, looked exactly like a huge and very fast-moving river. And in the middle of all of that water, there was a fire truck that had got trapped and a military truck too that had gone to rescue them. So pretty dramatic scenes throughout the day yesterday. As I say, things slightly calmer today, but still people very nervous about what might yet be to come here.
Donald Tusk has declared a state of natural disaster. What does that mean in practice?
In practice, that means that there's recourse to funding and to assistance from the EU. It means that Poland can call on the EU for help with logistics, for help with transport, potentially with more helicopters if they need it, and more vehicles to help evacuate people and to help with the rescue and the recovery, essentially. It also gives the government a little bit more power if they need to control population movements, if they need to order people to evacuate, or if they need to implement some kind of curfew or anything like that.
And Sarah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's not just that area. This is over a large part of Central and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Romania very, very badly affected. Several people killed there. We now know 4 people have lost their lives in Poland. In the Czech Republic, at the last count, I think at least 4 people have been swept away by the waters. And remember that a lot of people in this region think back to 1997, the moment that was called the Millennium Flood, the Great Floods of 1997. Now, in those floods, more than 100 people were killed. And lots of people are pointing out now that people locally and the authorities locally are much better prepared. They have more floodgates in place. They know better how to deal with this kind of emergency.
Sarah Rainsford. The Japanese historical epic Shogun has smashed all-time records and is named Best Drama at television's Emmy Awards in LA, the first foreign language TV series to win the Best Drama Award. Netflix's Baby Reindeer, a chilling story about a bartender stalked by a customer, was named Best Limited Series. Our LA correspondent Emma Vardy was there.
I thought Baby Reindeer was going to be a delightful children's story about Rudolph.
That's Jean Smart, who won Best Actress for her role in Hacks, introducing the Emmy nominees for one of the top awards of the night.
And the Emmy goes to Baby Reindeer!
Baby Reindeer, the show adapted from a one-man play, which became a surprise overnight Netflix hit, won nearly all of its categories. Richard Gadd, the creator of the show, said to be his own real-life story about sexual abuse and stalking, picked up awards for acting, writing and best drama.
Look, 10 years ago, I was down and out, right? I never ever thought I'd get my life together. I never ever thought I'd be able to rectify myself with what had happened to me and get myself back on my feet again. And then here I am, just over a decade later, picking up one of the biggest writing awards in television, yeah?
Jessica Gunning, Baby Reindeer.
While Jessica Gunning, who plays his obsessive stalker, won Best Supporting Actress.
Oh my goodness me, blinking heckers. Thank you so much. I honestly feel like I'm going to wake up any minute now, and this whole thing has been a dream. Thank you very, very much indeed. My biggest thanks, though, has to go to Mr. Richard Gadd. Oh no, just burst out crying. I've tried so many times to put into words what working on Baby Reindeer meant to me, and I fail every time. So I'm going to sing. No. No, imagine.
And the Emmy goes to Shogun.
The historical drama Shogun made Emmy's history, winning 18 awards, the most ever in a single season. The stars, Anna Sawai and Hiroyuki Sanada, became the first Japanese nominees to win Best Dramatic Actors.
And thank you for all the crew and cast of Shogun. I'm so proud of you. It was an East meets West dream project with respect. And Shogun taught me that when people work together, we can make miracle. We can create a better future together. Thank you so much.
And the TV industry has been in a slump, with less shows made this year and studios reining in their budgets. But with Baby Reindeer, one of the biggest winners of the night, it shows you don't need massive budgets to deliver compelling TV for audiences.
Emma Vardy. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer, and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.